Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. Thank you very much indeed for joining us for this press conference. The urgency of the situation in Sudan is something which has escaped the notice of a very large number of commentators here and elsewhere. And it's really to draw attention to that urgency that this conference has been called this afternoon. It's a very great pleasure to be able to welcome Archbishop Daniel Dengbolyak of Sudan, a good friend and a great champion of the rights of his people. It's a privilege that we're able to offer him hospitality here and that he's agreed to speak, and later today he will be meeting members of our government to speak on the issues that need addressing. I've also invited Bishop David Stancliffe of Salisbury to be with us this afternoon, because the Diocese of Salisbury has a long-standing and very many-layered relationship with the Episcopal Church of Sudan. It goes back for many years, and I believe that it's played a very significant part in the life both of the Diocese of Salisbury, I think it's fair to say, and also in the life of the Church of Sudan. Archbishop Daniel will say more in detail in a moment about the issues ahead of us, but I want to spend just a couple of minutes setting the scene. We are, as an international community, I believe, in danger of sleepwalking into a situation of real nightmare in Sudan. The hope that was offered some years ago by the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement has not been realized. And that's not simply a matter of hopes unrealized, it's a matter of confidence lost, of deprivation continuing, injustice being maintained, and in all kinds of ways, an intolerable situation simply not being addressed, a situation of grave injustice and of conflict. In recent years, the atrocities in Darfur have to some extent taken people's eyes away from the fact that there is an unresolved crisis between the north and the south in Sudan, and that the non-implementation of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement has meant that that wound has never been healed or addressed. The continuing lack of resolution of border issues, resource issues, and simply of the development of infrastructure in southern Sudan has meant a sense, I think, widespread in the south that the peace agreement has been almost meaningless. Add to this the growth of intertribal conflict, the spillage from the Darfur conflict into other areas of Sudan, and in some ways, most obviously, horrifically of all, the continuing activities of the Lord's Resistance Army coming across the border, and you have a situation which is a continuing humanitarian tragedy. This has been true for several years, so why underline it now? Two parts of an answer to that. The first is that Sudan is due for elections in the course of this coming year, and there is very grave doubt, as you might expect, that those elections will be conducted in any way that we would recognize as fair and democratic. In other words, there is a very immediate, time-bound need for the international community to do something about guaranteeing free and fair elections. And that connects with the second factor. Next year is the fixed date for the referendum on the separation of southern Sudan as a state on its own. Opinion is, I think it's fair to say, pretty sharply divided as to whether an independent southern Sudan would be in itself a viable state. But that's not essentially the question before us at the moment. The question is that should this year's elections not command the confidence of the Sudanese people in the south, then it's very obvious that a negative vote in the referendum is more or less guaranteed. Worse than that, there could be a unilateral move towards independence before then, with all the chaos that could supervene from that. So those are the two factors that make the Sudanese situation now so urgent. We hope, therefore, that the actions currently being taken, the campaign currently underway, and the beat for peace, project going on right at the moment in connection with Sudan. We hope that all of this will underline the pressing need for the international community to take a fresh look at the Sudanese situation, and to more than simply take a fresh look, but to put some monitoring structures in place for the elections this year, and of course to look again, and this is very important, at the extension and reinforcing of the United Nations mandate to guarantee the safety of civilians throughout Sudan in the immediate future. So pressure on governments and on the United Nations is of great importance at present. We hope, as I said earlier, that later this afternoon we'll be able to bring that pressure directly onto the table at Downing Street. But I think that's enough by way of introduction. And the most important testament to this will, of course, come from Sudan itself. So I'm very grateful that Archbishop Daniel is here, very proud to be able to introduce him as a colleague and friend, and invite him to speak to the situation. Daniel.
Thank you, His Grace, the Archbishop of Canterbury. My being here is for all of you, you know that it's the 5th anniversary of the CFA. We have now passed 5 years, and the Sudan have agreed that to stay together for 6 years, and we are left with only 12 months. The situation in Sudan, which brought the conflict, was a marginalization in the true cases of conflict in the Sudan. All this conflict in the Sudan, most of the Sudan periphery has been marginalized: Darfur, Blue Nile, Nova Mountain, Southern Sudan. So the problem of marginalization is the issue, and it was addressed by the CPA that should bring an end to marginalization, but that is not the case now. And that is why we as the church, we wanted to inform the international community to bring back pressure to the two parties who have signed the agreement. If it is the marginalization, the people of periphery, especially the Southern Sudan, Darfur, and other areas, since 1955, they've been marginalized. The CFA sets out a process whereby the marginalization should end and unity would be made attractive. The failure of the fully implementation of the CFA, which was signed in 2005, has results in a continuing marginalization, and therefore likely the division or a renewal of war may come back because the symptom of the war have not yet been removed. Sudan history is one of the two many agreement dishonest, said by one of our elder men called Abel Alier. There were two main agreements reached since 1955. Those agreements have never been implemented, so there is a fear that the CFA will be like one of them. The CFA is the current agreement on a referendum and popular consultation laws are simply process of paper until they are actually implemented on the ground. Sudanese politicians have lost the trust of the people regarding of honoring their own agreement. The international community must get more involved in the peace process in the Sudan, especially those government guarantors, the CPA of 2005, such as Britain, Norway, United States of America. These include traveling to Sudan, ground level monitoring of peace, and see whether the CPA has been implemented. If that thing is not done in the ground, then you will find one night that Sudan is back to war. If politician tension, tribalism, violence, and insecurity and allow to escalate furthermore in the country, there is very likely the danger for Sudan to go back, and it will be a dangerous path to see Sudan go back to war because it will involve the whole Central Africa, Congo, Uganda, Kenya, all those places will be under war because Sudan is being surrounded by 9 countries. The church remains committed to the CPA, to the right, every individual Sudanese citizen, to the basic freedom and documentation, right, and working for positive action for peace. We want it as a church to alert the international community so that they should not be blaming the church tomorrow that we have never informed them. It happened many times ago. When things happen in the Sudan, the church is usually told, oh, we have never been informed, but we are now ahead of the time to inform the international community for what is going to happen in the Sudan, and that is our fear. The church supports the recent statement of the international NGOs cooperating in the Sudan, which is highlighted the urgency of international action in the Sudan. The international community has a duty to protect the people of Sudan from continual marginalization and actions of violence. The time of talk is over. It is the time for action. Many people are talking, many people are trying to make conferences, many people are trying to say that and this. But this is the time for us, the Sudanese, the government, the international, have to come in and support these people then to talk far and not doing the action. So this is why I'm here with the Archbishop of Canterbury to inform you, to inform the Anglican Communion, to inform the government that there is a danger coming to Sudan. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Archbishop. The Archbishop has underlined the way in which the non-implementation of the CPA, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, is increasingly threatening a return to the chaos that over the years has claimed over 2 million lives in Sudan. And in the last year, the increase in violence, some 2,500 people killed in southern Sudan during last year alone, the increase in violence augurs very badly for the future. The political situation that's been described, the election this year, the referendum next year, has the threat of destabilizing and disrupting an already very fragile situation. And if in 18 months' time we see a return to the conditions that we all thought 5 years ago were, thank God, over, then I think the international community will bear a heavy responsibility for not asking what effective monitoring, intervention and support might mean. Some of that intervention and support has been given already in the form of international partnerships, not least with the Diocese of Salisbury. And I'll ask Bishop David to say a word briefly before I invite your questions.
We've been partners to the Episcopal Church in the Sudan for 37 years or so now, so have seen a good deal of the church and its work in the southern Sudan under very different sets of circumstances. When I first was able to travel there, and the civil war was still very much running, the first thing I was asked to do was to make sure I knew where the craters were, where I could go and dive into them in case a bomb fell. And you could hear the Antonovs. They were rather like those old-fashioned dentist drills worked by foot pumps, whirring around in the sky, very distinctive noise. And it's that kind of pressure that the country's been under for the last, at least 35 years, right through this period of the Civil War and these five fragile years of peace. And I think we all expected, with our partners there, that the Comprehensive Peace Agreement would bring substantial changes, that there will be investment in infrastructure in the southern Sudan, that there will be a fairer sharing of the revenues of the oil discovered in the disputed area between north and south. And boundary disputes are still an important matter to be resolved. So we have not only the matter of who knows that they can vote and how are people being educated to take their democratic opportunities seriously. We have the question about where the boundary should lie between the north and the south. And we have also the question of whether the register of voters is accurate. There is a lot of doubt about that. All these put uncertainty into the referendum that will come upon us in only a year's time. And it's for this combination of reasons that the situation in Sudan appears to the international community to be so intractable. Whichever way you cut it, there is another set of difficulties that appears. And that's why no one agency or no one NGO has the solution to it. It's not as if it was purely a matter of famine or food or grain. It's not a matter as if it was simply the oil revenues and the boundaries. It's not as if it was a matter simply of a poor educational opportunity in the south. There are hardly any secondary schools there. And one of the things that most cripples the southern Sudan is that there is no real educational provision beyond a very basic level. So where are the talented people of the southern Sudan going to be able to get a future from? In the past, many of them had to leave and get an education and then had to be persuaded to come back and sacrifice a lot of which they'd learned to enjoy in order to do that. There are people ready to do that now, but do we make it possible for them actually to come and bed in and do that and take their part in the recreation of the Sudan as a whole? We all know that the history of the Sudan is a troubled one because it has got so many national groupings within it. On the top of an essentially Arabic north were grafted countries of Central African style in the south. And these have never sat hugely conveniently or naturally together. And the stories of the south of the Sudan being displaced and made disaffected and its internal security threatened by the Lord's Resistance Army and the fact that they too turn out to have Chinese arms like a number of the other marauding groups do, and where is much of the oil wealth of the Sudan going but towards China? All this feeds back into a self-perpetuating group of issues which make us realize that no one solution is easy. And that's why everybody has to put energy into this. The churches are well placed on the ground. Our partners with Archbishop Paulino in Juba are very well disposed to working towards exactly the same goals as we are. All this allows us to say there is an opportunity on the ground to get some things going if there are sufficient resources put into formation and education of political consciousness, as well as to peacekeeping forces that can patrol the boundaries. I hope that with Archbishop Daniel later in the year there's an opportunity for us to step together between the borders of the southern Sudan and the northern Sudan, both of which have now got armed forces lined up against each other. Archbishop Daniel told me yesterday, if we can walk between the two, whatever small symbolic action that may be, that's part of what needs to happen if it's not to return to the kind of bloody chaos that there was before. And I'm really pleased that you're here and will be able to tell this to more people than we could possibly reach on our own.
Thank you very much. Before I invite questions, I'll just read the final paragraph of the very important statement made by the Provincial Standing Committee of the Church in Sudan back in November, which was a major statement addressed to the international community on the crisis and what was needed. We urge our international partners, it concludes, to take the message of the inviolability of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement to their respective governments who promised to guarantee peace in Sudan. Unless international support for the CPA is urgently stepped up, the Sudan is in very real danger of descending back into a war which will not harm those people who create it, but which will again destroy the lives of those voiceless masses for which the church now cries. I'd be very happy to invite questions. Yes, please.
What specifically will you propose to Gordon Brown on expressed concern that there would be a lot of people, a lot of groups excluded, and that would itself carry the risk of further conflict. Do you agree with that?
Thank you. First of all, what I will tell the Prime Minister is that the effort they did during the negotiation, during Naivasha, they put much effort, they put the manpower, they put the money until the agreement was signed in 2005. So I'm still asking the government of the United Kingdom, through the Prime Minister, to do the same effort they made. This is the time for them really to push much effort so that they should not allow these people to take the country back to war. And that's, we feel that the British government have an upper hand because they were the one who knows Sudan because they were the colony for it. And we feel that if they are part of this, then there will be peace in the country. The second part you have questioned, I did not get it well.
It's about elites. Will there be deals done between elites before the election and the referendum, which will increase the danger of people feeling not represented in the process?
Well, at the moment, the church and other groups of people who are concerned for peace, we are working hard to see to it that there is no deal done by elite. And because we feel that there's no alternative than the CPA. And that's why we are crying to the international for us to be helped, to push these people to the table and make the same way they have signed the agreement, then they should complete the agreement as it was written down. Because if we allow that gap to happen, then what you are saying, yes, can happen. But if all the internationals are there, the UK, the American, and all, we are there, then there will be no time for those elite to group together. That's why we are crying so that gap should not be given.
Thank you. May we take any other questions? Yes, please.
I'm sure by the Church Times. Archbishop Ben, could you tell me what's being done by the churches on the ground to prepare them for the election and the subsequent referendum? So at parish level, what sort of educational processes or preparatory processes are going on?
For us at the church, we took steps already. We are working on the ground. We are informing our parishioners, our bishops, to prepare our people for the danger coming and also to inform the people for the election, because we want them to this time we should elect those who will come and help the country, not of those who will come and just be a part of employment. So the church has taken that part. Myself, last year, I went to a place called Ayot. I was touring, so I managed to tour the whole southern Sudan. Now I am touring the northern Sudan. And what we are doing is to inform the people as part of our advocates as a church so that our people are not, again, driven away by something they don't know.
Thank you. Further questions? Yes.
I just wanted to pick up on something that Bishop David mentioned. You have an ongoing partnership with the church here in the UK, and he mentioned that there's a possibility that you may walk in between the armed groups that are facing one another. How can the church in the UK actually support the church in Sudan? It seems like they're very far apart. The conflict is over there, where we're here.
Well, I think the church in UK all long ago, especially David, as he put it correctly, even during the time we were being bombed, the church in UK was with us. They sent people to go be with us, and whenever I remember, there were a group of people from UK here when, and immediately the Antonov came, and all of them, they have to die under the ground. So we felt at that time that that is really a company. Even though there was a danger, but the church in the UK was with us. What he's mentioning is that, yes, I when I was coming, I you could see the army from the north and army from the south. They are very close to each other. And they when you pass through, you pass as if you are going to a different country. You are searched thoroughly when you are crossing to the north. When you are crossing to the south, you are searched, and even if you talk, you may be getting rough life questions from any side you are talking with them. So there is a really fear. So what he was saying, if the church could go and walk between the two armies, so that to show the solidarity that we, the church, we don't want what is happening here. That's what he meant.
David, you want to add something to that?
I think hardly at all, except that it is by doing things like that, because it is what we actually go and do, you know, that speaks so much. And of course, there are lots of things like that happening, but making them visible to the whole world is what is really important for us. And I think any way which we can encourage you to come with us when we make a visit to the Sudan like that, I mean, I try and get to, or Bishop Graham will try and get to the Sudan in the next few months. And, you know, if any of you can come too, that would be really good, because quite a lot of the difficulty we have is allowing other people to see what's actually going on. And what's actually going on and the way people treat each other tells so much. I mean, when I first went in the early 90s, you know, the northern bishops couldn't meet the southern bishops. So if we had a bishops' meeting, we had to bring them all out of the country to have any kind of conference or meeting together. And that's gone on until only 5 or 6 years ago. But it's seeing what happens to those bishops who have grown up being told that each other were the enemy when they were bishops in the same church, but were determined to stick together and overcome that. That's what has really changed people's minds in the Sudan. And getting you to come and take photographs is only part of what we need.
Thank you.
This is ignorant and pessimistic question, but if there is a war, what constitutes victory? How would we end it?
What would constitute victory if there is a war between North and South?
A victory, I think that we, as the church, we are not looking for a victory, but we are looking for a victory of peace. That a country like Sudan, these people have been fighting for over 22 years, but nobody has defeated anybody among them. But still, they are still hovering that to have to make war again. Nobody have defeated each other. So for us, we wanted the victory of peace, and that's why we are championing it as a church. Let the victory of peace be continuing, so that our people have a peaceful life. That's what we are for.
I think, if I can come in on that, the fact that there's been no outcome to the civil war that could be construed as victory over the past years does tell its own story, which I guess is where your question comes from. I think for the North, victory would simply be a matter of keeping control of resources,
yes.
And
yes.
Simply control of its present monopoly on,
yeah,
you know, the welfare and well-being of the entire territory. For the South, victory would be establishing its control of resources and its capacity to build an infrastructure. But that's exactly what is so vulnerable with an aggressive neighbour and an extremely weak infrastructure already existing. So it's a good question, unfortunately, however pessimistic.
Effective in getting the government to come to implement the agreement.
thank you. If you heard recently what happened to the top politicians, top leadership of the SPLM, when they expressed the democracy, they were all locked in Khartoum. That was a very clear, and that's why we say there is a danger. So if the leadership of the SPLM, who are a party to, who have signed an agreement with the North, are to be locked in, what do you expect to happen to those who are not a party to this? So you could see the danger there. These people were locked in, they were beaten, as if they are not leaders. So that is the danger. So they cannot persuade, as far as they have been locked in Khartoum. Yes, they may not. They are even saying, we don't want a Southern Sudan to break. That's what the North is saying. But we are saying, no, that is not the question at the moment. The question is the CPA is to be implemented fully, including the referendum. Let the people of Southern Sudan be questioned. Do they need a united Sudan or do they need a secession? It is they who will say it now, we want to separate or united Sudan. But we cannot tell them that today, oh, the Southern Sudan is going to separate.
Yeah. Going back to what Archbishop Daniel said a bit earlier, the question is, I think, whether there is any way of the Southern Sudan seeing that a unified Sudan is to its advantage. And unless the CPA is implemented, that is a non-question, I think.
That's a question.
One other thing I think Bishop David would agree with is, we've both seen in a small way what it is for Southern politicians to be in a thoroughly intimidating and insecure environment in Khartoum, and how very different it is to be a Southern political leader in the context of Khartoum.
When you are only being kind of given a little handout,
it's a
token and grace and favour, which could be withdrawn at any moment, as Archbishop Daniel just says. I mean, anybody who makes serious representations, I think, is at risk then of being silenced in a number of ways.
The question was raised when we were together in Sudan a few years ago of the need for, in an ideal world, for a sort of Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Sudan on the South African model because of the depth of trauma over many years. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, but that is the kind of confrontation with the recent past that is needed for the air to be cleared. Jim.
I'm Jim Rosenbaum, representing the Living Church of the United States magazine. You have many friends in the United States, especially in the Diocese of Virginia and Chicago, and there are many programs to help Sudanese refugees. Are there any programs that can bring the Sudanese people who are now getting higher education, the need for education, how to get those people back so they can become the decision makers in these complicated processes? Is there something that can be done in that regard?
Thank you. I think that was 2 years ago we discussed that one, and there was some organization in the U.S., who supposed to employ the Sudanese who are in diasporas and send them to Sudan, especially to work in Southern Sudan. And that was a very good program because those Sudanese who have education in diaspora, they cannot come back as such because when they come back, they don't have a job. And that will not make them to stay in the country. So it was an appeal that all the NGOs working in Europe or in America should employ the diasporas and send them to Sudan, because there are a lot of organizations working now in the country. But unfortunately enough, we ended up seeing that the employees who are now working in the Sudan are either from Kenya, from Uganda, from other part of the world, leaving the diasporas not to be brought to Sudan. So it is those organizations who have not implemented, but that idea was there.
We have time for a couple more questions before drawing a line.
I understand your reluctance to talk about the referendum there's a general sense that the Christian Church in the South is pushing very hard for a separation. But I have heard that even though the separation may well happen next year, if the process could take a very long time after the separation of humans who were formally declared. Could you talk about the process after the separation, which might take quite a long time for the two countries to separate? What arrangements there might be, or what thinking you might be doing already about that?
For us as a church, we have never talked about separation. We are talking of that implementation of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, because it is the Comprehensive Peace Agreement which will give us the timeline, whether the Sudan is divided into two or it is remaining as a one country. For us, what we are campaigning as a church is to make sure that these people should not go back to war. That is our message. The question of whether Sudan is going to be divided is left to the people of Southern Sudan to decide. It's left to the people of Abyei to decide. It's left to the people of Blue Nile and Southern Kordofan. These are the people who are going to be us. For us, we need you as the international that to support a document which has been agreed by these people. And that document has contained all these things, and we have to let them exercise their rights. So that is what we are campaigning. We are not campaigning for as a church. No church has talked of separation. The church is talking of that, please help us to let these people exercise their rights.
Is there a final question? Perhaps just before we do conclude, I might add, going back to the earliest question about what will be the subject matter of further discussions. In the drawing up of the CPA, of course, there was a crucial role played by the so-called Troika of the United States, the United Kingdom, and Norway. One of the particular questions at the moment is how that group can be not only reactivated but enlarged, perhaps to draw in other African players, and to ask what sort of involvement China could have positively rather than negatively, which is a rather pressing question. Archbishop Deng knows that all too well from close experience. On top of that, there is the idea that we should be looking to a single senior high-level negotiator from somewhere in Africa who could be the driver of policy in this area, in collaboration with the Troika, the enlarged Troika. These are some of the ideas that are currently going around, and I personally would very much want to explore that idea of how a high-level mediator-negotiator can be a sort of confluence point for some of this in the reactivated Troika. David, you've spoken about this recently.
Yes. I think we could probably add to that or make the link between that and what the Archbishop just said about Justice and Reconciliation Commissions. Yes. Later.
Yes.
There are, you know, anywhere you could cut Sudan, you will find dividing lines between north and south, between the Arab culture and the Central African culture, between Islam and Christianity, between those who see a military solution and those who are longing for peace. All the way through, you could find a number of different ways of doing it. And in the end, it's not ever going to be a question of a victory of one kind or another, which means the diminution of the other. And that's what the Archbishop and I experienced, I think, in Khartoum, when we saw southern politicians being treated as if they were at the table of the King of Babylon in the 7th century BC. And it's that kind of world still living there, and only a single figure or a group of figures who are determined to act together and begin the process, in a sense, of reconciliation, and that has to include the kind of conversations that I watched the Archbishop having in Khartoum with senior Muslim leaders, at the end of which one of them came out and said to me, I suppose our difficulty is that we don't have a theology of the incarnation. Well, that's a long way along on interreligious dialogue. And it's that kind of exchange, person to person, where people can learn to trust each other, which will be the only way in which progress will in the end be made. And I think that at the moment, the people in Khartoum and the people in the South aren't capable on their own of having that conversation. And if some means can be found for that conversation to actually happen, then we might be able to get started. But I think that's, you know, we will be entirely united in what we thought about that kind of possibility as being the best way forward for the future foundation.
Thank you. Thank you all very much indeed. It's been very good to welcome so considerable a number this afternoon, and I can only repeat what's already been said. Please tell people about this as a matter of urgency. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.